Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Behind the scenes at Per Se, a four-star restaurant in New York City, a sister restaurant to the French Laundry in Napa, California, is one of the several topics in this edition of Radio Curious. Phoebe Damrosch, author of Service Included, Four-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter, was the first female captain in a New York City four-star restaurant. A graduate of Columbia University's Barnard College, Phoebe shares surprising episodes and charm in a story relayed from the always pleasant server's point of view that some people spend several hundred dollars a meal to witness from the diner's perspective. However, Phoebe sees things that the diners don't. Phoebe Damrosch was born in a small rural mountaintop cabin next to a pure water lake several hours north of New York City and grew up partly in Vermont and partly in rural Haiti. In this conversation, recorded on July 15, 2008, we began when I asked her to explain what a restaurant must do to receive the four-star nomination.
It seems that there are certain formulas that have to be followed, and I think that that's changing a little bit. I've noticed that in the past few years, there's a new trend towards more casual dining, less comfortable, less ritualistic dining. But none of those are getting four stars. And it seems that the four stars still have that kind of pomp and circumstance that, you know, things arriving on carts and things being shaved onto your plate and poured into your glass with some sort of ritual to it. There's a few ways that restaurants are graded, basically, in different systems. So the New York Times four stars in New York is very important, but in other places, obviously not. The Michelin guide is important, the Mobile five stars. And a lot of them have a whole series of things that you have to pass. For example, I remember hearing one time that the ice can't have holes in it. You know how you go to some restaurants and there's like a little hole in the ice? I think that there are a lot of sort of tests that need to be passed like that you would never even know.
Are these tests of show or are they of quality of the food?
I think it really depends on how you feel about fine dining. You know, some people think of all of these as show. I'm sure the people who own the restaurants, the chefs, believe that it's a sign of quality. I feel that, in my experience, that it was really a sign of quality. I've never seen anyone put as much energy and attention to detail into something as we did into putting in opening that restaurant. We trained for months on how to stand and how to breathe and how to speak, and the chefs did the same with, you know, how to stir. And
well, give us some examples how the wait staff should stand and speak and breathe.
It's interesting because we were working off of the French model. Per Se is basically a French-influenced American restaurant, and the other restaurant on which it was based is the French Laundry in the Napa Valley. And so because it had this sort of California feel, which is a little different than the French vibe, it's a little bit more casual, it was a blend of those two things. So the French way of, for example, pouring something from the right side of the guest, pouring wine from the right side of the guest. But then we had the sort of California vibe, which was only do that if it makes the guest feel comfortable. So if people are having a conversation and putting a bottle on the right side of the person would break the eye contact between the two people having a conversation, you would then pour from the left so that they continue to have their conversation. You don't need to follow the rules. You follow what makes more sense for the table.
So it's observing the social interaction in the table.
Exactly, while also knowing what the correct rules are so that you're choosing to break that rule, but you're also aware that that is the rule. Watching the social interaction was really what I found most fascinating about the job.
What did you see?
Oh, just a lot of it was what I heard. The snippets of dialogue and understanding how people were connected at the table was always an interesting puzzle to put together. You know, are these people connected through business or family, or is this an important moment? A lot of times when people come into a high-end restaurant like that, they're coming for a very important moment in their life, whether it's a proposal or an important meeting or a reunion of sorts. It was interesting to figure out intellectually what's going on, and then also what is my role here? Do I need to act as a distraction for these people? Do I need to keep the conversation going? Is there something awkward? And if this is a 3-hour, 4-hour long meal, and they're having a hard time interacting, then I'm going to need to spend a little more time at that table than I might otherwise.
When you do spend that time, I'm not sure how you would characterize your role as the fomentor of the social interaction, but what sort of thing do you do?
I think so much of this is just emotional intelligence. It's a sort of getting a sense of what's going on. You can usually read someone's cues. I mean, there are certain physical cues, like when someone is fiddling with something on their table, oftentimes they'll fiddle with it before they're aware that they want something. So they'll be fiddling with the bottom of their wine glass before they realize that what they really want is to order another bottle. Or they start to kind of get fidgety in their chair, and that means that they're about to get up, but they're not really even aware of the fact that they're about to get up. And some of it is just kind of reading the mood, that if this is supposed to be a business dinner and people aren't really interacting, then something needs to happen at the table. There needs to be some sort of distraction that would kind of bring them together. A lot of it is not as conscious as I'm making it sound. A lot of it is kind of just getting a feel for what needs to happen.
Well, let's talk about the role of a captain in a restaurant.
A captain is kind of like a waiter in any other restaurant, except that there's this major hierarchy in these fine dining restaurants where you have the general manager at the top, and then the maitre d' is the person who checks the people in at the door, and they usually need to know the who's who, read gossip columns and all of the magazines, so they recognize a face. If the mayor of San Francisco walks in, we need to know who he is on the East Coast as well as the West Coast, so that we'll give him a table. And then below that, then you have the captain and the sommeliers, who are kind of managing a section. So I would have 4 tables, and those tables I was responsible for everything that happened under me. So even though the person who was right under me was the back server, who was the person who was serving the bread and the water and putting the silverware down on the table, and then you had a bunch of runners who would be bringing the food from the kitchen, and it was my job to make sure that everything went smoothly and to be more of a presence for the people at the table, so that if there was anything wrong, it would be me who would be taking care of that, or I would be the point person.
The captain is the point person.
The captain. But what could happen, actually, is that captain could really do very little and let the station run on its own based on the back server and the runners and, everyone doing their job, but there would be very little personality, and maybe the people at the table wouldn't feel that they had really made a connection with someone at the restaurant.
So what may be commonly called the waiter is the person who brings the menus and takes the order.
Yeah. And often does the wine service, depending on their wine knowledge.
Well, you became the first female captain in a 4-star restaurant.
Right.
What social conglomeration brought that around?
Well, that's what I was saying, that it was based on the French model. I think that there is a very Western European feel in a lot of these really high-end restaurants. I don't know who's more comfortable. Is it the guests that are more comfortable with it, or the managers who are doing hiring? But it definitely seems that most people are more comfortable with a white male serving these Western European foods and wines. And it becomes a little challenging when you have a woman there, and then even more challenging when you have a minority. And what's very interesting right now is to think about, I'm sure it's like this in other parts of the country too, but how many Latino, Hispanic people we have working in the kitchen, and often at the kind of bottom levels of the restaurants, running food or making coffee or changing tablecloths, but they're not really moving up very quickly. And it is a little bit unclear about why they're not moving up. And I wanted to speak from my experience, which was as a woman. I think it really is an issue that transcends just gender. But I also think that I had it a little bit easier because we had this California history, and Laura Cunningham, who is the woman who designed the service at the French Laundry, she had a real interest in bringing more women onto the floor. And so I think I had a little bit of an easier time moving up than I might have in maybe at Ducasse or Danielle or Le Bernardin.
What do you think is the social origin of, might be characterized by some, the racist and sexist denomination of a white male being the server?
I think it's just what we're used to. But what was so interesting to me was that service and caretaking and hospitality is traditionally a very female realm, unless you start making a lot of money and then suddenly it becomes a male realm. It was very bizarre experience for me, and I wrote about this in the book, was that suddenly I felt like here I am doing very traditional female roles, and yet it seems strange that I'm a woman doing this. I mean, and here I am, I'm wearing a men's suit, a suit jacket and a tie and a buttoned-up collar, dressed like a man but doing a very female role. It was bizarre. And it actually made me very angry that I had to wear that outfit.
Was there anything you could do about it besides wear it?
No, the guests used to comment sometimes. They'd say, why did they make you wear that suit and that tie? And I would say, please, talk to someone about this. I think this needs to change. Just because I felt like, why? Because I'm in this position of power in this restaurant, why do I have to dress like a man? I found that really offensive.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Phoebe Damrosch. She's the author of a book called Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Phoebe, the relationship between the service staff and the chefs is very complex.
Yeah.
Share some of that with us.
There's often a big line, a big divide between the people who work, we say the front of the house and the back of the house, the people in the kitchen and the back, and the dining room staff. And I think most of that comes down to a discrepancy in income. And most restaurants, the chefs make very, very little money. And oftentimes they're the people who have actually trained for their job. They've been to culinary school. They have major debts to pay off. Or else they've just spent years working their way up from peeling potatoes to where they are on the line. And they work really long hours, and it's grueling and hot. And they don't get very much respect, although now they're getting a little bit more respect with Top Chef and this whole celebrity chef culture. However, the people in the front of the house who are potentially a bunch of starving artists who are terrible at their job and don't like it very much and work half the hours make way, way more money. And so you have this resentment that builds between these two groups. I think that in the best of restaurants, people can really get behind the feelings that they're working towards something a little bit bigger, and that putting the guest first and making this really great experience with great food and service, and everyone works together. And at Per Se, we had a little bit more of that experience. It was a group effort. But there was still a little bit of those residual tensions. And in other restaurants where I've worked, it's been pretty divided.
Why is there such an economic discrepancy?
Well, I think it just has to do with the way everyone is paid, that waiters work on tips, and no one can touch those tips legally. That's something that's divided up between the service staff themselves, and the people in the back are paid by the restaurant. It's really weird. I don't quite understand how the restaurant industry has gotten away with not paying their employees. And it seems to me that it would be much more fair, and I touch on this a little bit at the end of the book. We started a service charge at Per Se. It was right when I left. If restaurants were to start paying everyone a salary, then it could be equalized. But that would require a service charge on the check, and it would require Americans to shift our consciousness a little bit and be willing to, you know, shell out a certain percentage and not have control over the tipping.
Would it be truly a service charge on the check, or would it just be raising the price of each item on the menu?
I think you can raise the price of literally everything in the restaurant by 20% or something, and then it would just be included. But it would still say at the bottom of the check, you know, a certain percentage has been included in the check. Or just services included, I guess it could say on the bottom.
So service included at Per Se, the 20% that was added just before you left your time there, became the name of the book.
Yeah. And it was a working title, and I wasn't sure I wanted to keep it, but I got talked into it. I didn't want it to be a snarky title, but it did seem kind of fitting. I don't know, and I feel that it's it could be a really fair way of paying people. But your original question was the dynamic between the chef and the waiters, and that can be a little bit different. That it's not always monetary. There's a little bit of a dynamic between the fact that the chef is usually stuck in the kitchen not interacting with the guests, and the waiter is the person, or the captain, or whatever you want to call it, is the person who's brokering the relationship between the guest and the chef. And that can be a really tricky situation if you have the kind of the kind of diner who wants mint jelly with her lamb chop, and you have the chef who, you know, has made this really special reduction and refuses to give you mint jelly, then it's the waiter's job to figure out, how can I make sure that these people get what they want and the chef isn't going to bite my head off? And there's a lot of, you know, a lot of that sort of interpersonal, you know, dynamic going on there as well.
Well, you say in your book, the first thing you learn as a waiter is when to get the hell out of the kitchen.
That's right, because, you know, a lot of times, you know, I think guests often forget that the waiter really is on their side and is trying to get them what they're asking for, but sometimes there's nothing that we can do. Sometimes some chefs take their food very, very personally and don't like to make any changes and have serious tempers, and they work long hours, and, you know, that's a stereotype that's often true.
You made an unusual comment in your book, Service Included, Four-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. When you talked about people who tended to overindulge to the extent that more people vomited in the dining room of Per Se than in other restaurants.
Yeah, and then the New York Times did a whole story about how this is actually really common in a lot of different restaurants, and I was kind of relieved because I had felt like I didn't want to make it seem like it was just an issue at Per Se. But what I found interesting was that no matter how much people are paying, and no matter how long they have to wait for a reservation, so here I think they're paying something like $275 a menu now, and the wait is exactly 60 days, that you'd think that people would really be on their best behavior when they got to their table. But what I realized is just that people are people no matter where they are, and that they will, you know, maybe they had been starving themselves for days in anticipation for the meal, so, you know, the few glasses of champagne at the beginning went right to their heads, or maybe they were just not used to eating 9 courses of foie gras and truffles and caviar. But yeah, people would vomit, people would, fall asleep at the table, just this whole series of all these different, inappropriate things that we would all shake our heads and wonder, you know, where they learned their manners. And I really realized that there is no connection at all between wealth and manners. And I'd always kind of wondered, and it was confirmed Per Se. But the article in the New York Times is talking about other things, that, you know, people jumping in fountains at the Four Seasons, drunk people jumping in the fountain and things like that. So I guess it's fairly common.
Phoebe Damrosch, author of Service Included, Four-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter, is there a portion of the book that you most enjoyed writing?
The chapter that I find that I enjoyed writing the most was the one that's called I Can Hear You, where I do the different snapshots of different tables. And I think it's because that's what I liked most in my job. But I notice as I've done readings that those are the things that really work, that reading a series of those works better than reading any other part of the book.
I got a sense, Phoebe, that in your book, you kind of take a flair for an underlying view of the comedy of the human interaction that's going on, even to the extent that you would wear candy cane striped socks under your black trousers.
How pathetic is that? That's the only form of rebellion that I could really get away with was striped socks, because they were supposed to be black. But yeah, I mean, in some ways, you have to add that layer and be willing to look at it as kind of a comedy, a social comedy. Because if you don't, then you can take it so seriously, and it's really no fun for anyone. This is the kind of place that can seem very somber. And some of the first reviews were, you know, they called us ghostly, the waiters, and they said that, you know, it was too quiet in the dining room and too spare and too serious, and we took ourselves too seriously. And so I think that we all needed to have as much of that as we possibly could bring, the life and the sense of humor and the acknowledgement that it was a little absurd, that rattling off the names of the cows who make the butter is a little absurd, but it's also fun. And if you can make it fun and you can make people get that there's a sense of humor to it, then it's much more enjoyable. And I think Thomas Keller, he really gets that. I mean, the names of his dishes are things like soup in a sandwich, but the sandwich has truffles in it, or coffee and donuts, and it's a cappuccino semifreddo and a cinnamon sugar donut. Things like, he has a real sense of humor in his food, and I think it was our job to bring that sense of humor into the dining room as well.
Thomas Keller, the chef of Per Se, your report has a little poster in the kitchen that says, "What would you do if you knew you could not fail?"
Right. He was kind of famous for putting up these posters all over. When he would come to town, he spent most of his time in California, but when he would come to town, suddenly there would be these signs all over the kitchen with blue tape on all four sides. And that was one that I read towards the end of my experience there. And it was one of these just important moments for me where I read that and realized that I actually wasn't doing what I wanted to be doing anymore. That this whole 18 months that I had spent there was fascinating, and it was a real learning curve, but it wasn't something I wanted to do for the rest of my life, and that I had really learned from it what I wanted to learn, and that what I wanted to do was try to document the experience so that the people who can't afford to spend $275 and wait 60 days to get in will be able to understand what this level of dining is, whether or not they feel, you know, whatever their opinion about spending that kind of money is, just to know that it's out there and that this is an experience that is available to people. And also to bring a little bit of glamour to the profession of service, which is something that I think a lot of people have a lot of shame about, but I think is noble and fun and interesting and intellectual and nothing to be ashamed of. So I really wanted to document that in the book, and that's what that sign did for me. It forced me to do that.
When you say a lot of people have shame about it.
Yeah, the sense of I'm just a waiter while I'm doing something else. You know, a lot of times people would come in and say, "So what else do you do?" as a kind of compliment to me. Like, you're not just a waiter. I think that you're capable of more. But really, what they were saying was, what you're doing right now is not very interesting to me, or it's not worthwhile, or you went to an Ivy League college. What are you doing with yourself? Whereas I found this to be a really fascinating job for a while I had it. And a lot of people can make an incredible living doing waiting tables and really enjoy it and can support a family and have health insurance and 401k. And so why shouldn't they?
So now that you've left Per Se, the question is, what would you do if you knew you could not fail?
Well, Barry, that's a tough question, and I think it is writing another book, but I'm having a little hard time getting started on that. But yeah, I'd like to keep writing.
Do you have a feeling for the topic?
I've started three and not finished yet, but I will write another one. And it's kind of, in the beginning, it was a question of whether I wanted to continue writing about food or take on another topic, and I think I'm ready to do another topic.
Well, Phoebe Damrosch, author of Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious and have a couple of questions before we close.
Okay.
First is, what's an important thing that you've learned recently?
Am I allowed to answer this question in a long-winded way?
Let's give it a try.
Okay. Well, I'm sitting here with a huge pregnant belly about to deliver any day, and I've found this whole experience of pregnancy and learning where we are as a society in terms of birth is fascinating to me. And it was one of these things, just like waiting tables, that I didn't expect to be as interesting, and I didn't expect to have as many feelings and thoughts about it as I do. So this whole process has really changed how I think about women and bodies in our society right now.
What are the changes that you've learned?
Well, it seems, looking at my peers, that people are really filing in to these highly medicated births you know, these inducements and cesareans and, you know, tons of drugs and this fear about everything relating to our bodies. Whereas when I think about my mother's generation and when I was born in the 70s, there was much more of an interest in the natural birth and trusting the body's process and trusting the community of women to pass on this wisdom to each other. And we've really lost that. And I don't see my peers as being interested in that. And I found that I'm really going back to my mother and her friends and asking, you know, what happened here? What should I be learning from this experience, as opposed to going to my doctor and asking those questions?
You were born in a remote log cabin near a rural lake several hours north of New York City,
right,
next to a lake that had drinkable water in it. Where will your baby be born?
At home, hopefully in the kitchen, which seems really fitting. That, you know, if everything goes smoothly, that's the plan with a midwife. And I've been getting a lot of flack from not my family, as you might imagine from the description you just gave, but from my peers. Just, what are you thinking, and is this safe? That's the question, is it safe? Which is really the question that everyone's asking about everything right now.
Well, I guess you'll find out.
I will. And I think there's a little bit more to it than just safety. I think that there's some more things to learn from the experience than just being safe.
And finally, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes. I just joined the public library, and I'm ashamed to say that I hadn't done that for a long time. But it's great. And I found I have a whole long list of books on reserve now. And the recent one that I've loved was Junot Diaz's book, Drown. And he's a Dominican-American writer who grew up mostly in the Dominican Republic and in New Jersey. And it's a series of autobiographical essays that are connected about the immigrant experience. And it's really very raw and one of these books that you almost feel in your body and in the mood of it more than in your head. I was very moved by it.
Phoebe Damrosch, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Phoebe Damrosch is the author of Service Included, 4-Star Secrets of an Eavesdropping Waiter. The book she recommends is Drown by Junot Diaz. This interview was recorded on July 15th, 2008. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. And the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.